And now a song from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, Working Folk Unite.
Conditions, they are bad, and some of you are sad. You cannot see your enemy, the class that lives in luxury. Working folk are poor, will be forevermore, as long as you permit the few to guide your destiny. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty. Working folk unite, we must put up a fight to make us free from slavery and capitalistic tyranny. This fight is not in vain, we've got a world to gain. Will you be a fool to a capitalist tool and serve your enemy? Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. This earth by right belongs to toilers and not to spoilers of liberty.
Welcome one, welcome all to WOB Radio, no longer our. We have been graciously afforded 90 minutes by our host, 101.9 Radio Tacoma Low Power FM. This is a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, a union for all workers and all trades. My name is fellow worker Noah, and I use he, him pronouns, and we're going to go around the table and introduce ourselves. Why don't we start off with you?
I'm Alan, and it's he, him as well.
I am Lynn, and I am she, her. And I'm a fellow worker.
I'm fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns.
All right. And to give us a bit of an introduction as to what the IWW is, we have a couple selections of the preamble to read off to you today. This is the preamble of the Constitution of the IWW. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. We find that the centering of management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. Thank you once again so much for tuning in to WOB Radio. We have some sections of labor news to give to you today. We have a roundtable discussion on the role of police unions when it comes to instances of brutality and seeking justice for police officers who commit crime. We also have a labor law brief on the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948. We have Gordon giving us some wonderful news out from the Kitsap Peninsula. We have an environmental report from fellow worker Marilyn, as well as some announcements on local events, previous and upcoming. So thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope that you enjoy the show. And starting today with labor-related news, probably one of the biggest stories currently breaking over the past couple days. This is from the New York Times. A train derailment caused a large fire to erupt in eastern Ohio on Friday night, prompting officials to order many of the town's residents to evacuate as crews assessed whether the cargo contained toxic material, and it does, and we're going to get to that. The authorities said, the risk of injury remained a concern on Sunday because of the lingering threat of a potential explosion. 50 cars were derailed around 9 p.m. Friday in East Palestine, Ohio, which has about 4,700 residents and is 50 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Now, the reason why this is so important is twofold. One, many of these rail cars that were derailed contain a chemical known as vinyl chloride, which is particularly hazardous for human exposure. The local fire department has agreed to allow for a controlled burn in order for some of these rail cars, which are already on fire, to essentially just burn off their contents. It has been burning for days. There is a huge black plume currently over northeastern Ohio, as well as contamination into the groundwater as well. There have been videos on social media of chlorine-scented water with dead fish flowing through it. There have been birds seen migrating en masse away from the situation, some of them falling out of the sky dead. There was an instance of a journalist which was present at one of the newsroom gatherings that was arrested for trying to report on the details specifically related to human exposure. So this situation is currently unfolding, but it appears that essentially all of these rail cars derailed. There's a toxic material currently burning into the air and leaking into the water. Pretty much the entire town has been evacuated, and nobody knows when they're going to be able to go back to their homes. And there already appears to be some very immediate environmental effects. The one interesting thing that I found looking up this story is that actually somebody interviewed a rail worker, and he was talking about how basically they've shortened the amount of time that they inspect rail cars before they leave stations. They wanted 3 minutes for each car. They only have 90 seconds to make sure that the cars are functional enough to ride on the rails before they go out. And this fellow worker had stated that this problem was both predictable and preventable. And since they were not able to negotiate for longer inspection times, amongst other things, in regards to the previous threat of a rail strike, they essentially have to work with, as we've said before, smaller crews and shorter amount of time for safety inspections. So this is directly related to Congress forcing them to not strike and accept the contract mitigation that they had voted on. So, any thoughts on that?
That issue, encroaches on so many subjects, or intersects with so many subjects. We've talked about reducing the crews on trains before. We've talked about the oil cars and the liquid natural gas cars and things like that right here in Tacoma and running right through Olympia and other, you know, heavily populated areas. And how all this intersects with rapacious profits, a lack of union strength, and also the environmental issues involved. Mm-hmm. How this is poisoning, you know. Okay, so the last big one like this was in Quebec, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was Lake Megantic. And that's what a fellow worker Marilyn brought up a couple of times in previous meetings. But it's up in Canada. So in the United States, even if it's just across the border in Canada, we have a tendency to say, well, that's their problem. You know, but actually it's a North America-wide problem with the freight rail carriers who are for-profit businesses. And so lifting regulations, forcing the workers back to strike under, I guess, Taft-Hartley, or whatever law that they plucked out of the sky to...
Well, they can't wildcat, that's for sure.
Yeah, but...
Well, wait a minute. Yes, they can.
Well, they can.
They can.
But labor law would wave its finger at them.
And the cops would come with guns. Yeah,
yeah, pretty much.
Back to work, slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thoughts on the issue, that it intersects with so many things. First of all, you know, condolences to the people who have been hurt or the fatalities.
Huh? And will be hurt. We don't know the full environmental effect of this yet.
They poisoned the ground. That's right in the middle of the Rust Belt. I've been in that area. It's right where West Virginia comes up in between Pennsylvania and Ohio. And it's the old industrial area of the United States, and it lacks maintenance, it lacks attention, and it lacks concern mm-hmm. by the government and by the owners of the railroads.
Yeah, absolutely. It will be very interesting to see how this turns out. Some people on social media are even describing it as the American Chernobyl, because it's an ongoing accident of mm-hmm. potentially very large proportions, but we do not know what the scale of that is going to be until quite literally the smoke settles down.
Yeah.
So, what to do,
yeah,
if anything.
Yeah. And there was actually another video I saw on TikTok. There was a man standing in his backyard looking up at the clouds, and it looks like storm clouds overhead. You know how after a thunderstorm passes, there are those mammatus clouds that hang down?
Yeah.
It was that, but it was all smoke from the fire. And he was 10 miles away, and it just blanketed the sky. So
that's terrible.
No major mainstream media outlet, as at time of recording, has really covered this too much in depth. It's being treated as a minor rail fire with a controlled burn because of potentially hazardous substances. Mm. But the focus on the ground is people are going to be hurt by this in the long term. And the rail workers wanted to keep this from happening, but Congress essentially forced them to, like you said, get back to work slaves and deal with what conditions that they were given by their employers and by Congress. So
let's go back to the proposed or attempted railway workers strike.
Mm-hmm.
And Biden said, you have to go back to work mm-hmm. because you're so important to the economy that you can't take time off to go to see a doctor when you're mm-hmm. sick. That struck me as really odd. I mean, if they are that important to the economy, then by golly, they should get as much time off to go to the doctor as they want, and why not get the raise they asked right. for anyway?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that makes no sense.
That's right. It's a contradiction that makes no sense. They're very important. We don't care what happens to you.
We've seen that kind of propaganda since the beginning of the COVID crisis. Everybody is an essential worker. You have to keep working in order to keep the economy going so the country doesn't collapse, but we're not going to take care of you. And by the way, you're supposed to... Biden still owes me $600. Because I guess the $600 I got from Trump... Sorry, the $1,800 I got from Trump and the extra $600 I got from him equals $2,000, even though he said $2,000, but that's in a whole nother conversation. But yeah, no, it just goes to show that the most essential parts of what makes the economy and the supply chain, the well-being of people's lives is so thinly supported and threaded together that all it takes is one good disaster to expose its contradictions. Mm-hmm. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
My thought was that just like in a natural disaster, which is a natural disaster, the idea of having to leave your home immediately upon being ordered, mandated by the government, which I think was a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
How disrupting is that to thousands, and I don't know how the population of, you know, the numbers, but to just have no idea whether you can ever go back to your home, probably pets and all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine what a disruption that just is part of greed and capitalism. And,
yeah. Who knows how long those people are going to have to be out of their homes, getting disrupted from their jobs, having to find another place to live for the time being, whether that's a hotel or a friend that little family that lives hours away, possibly.
And maybe they're already toxic.
Yeah.
Just being there.
That close to those fumes. And again, I'm no chemist. I have no idea what the kind of fallout from this kind of situation is. But if their homes are being dusted with a potentially toxic material, you know, their backyards could be completely contaminated, just like the Asarco smelter here in Tacoma. You know, their property could be contaminated. That could be seized by the government, which means they lose their home for good. We really don't know the full effects because it isn't being adequately covered by the media, save for a couple people who have been either arrested or just aren't getting on the nightly news.
Yeah, to that point, it's been noted in the progressive press online that this is not being covered at all by the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not at all. They're concentrated on the Super Bowl, really.
Or the balloons.
Yeah. I think that's the most comical.
Yeah.
But the point is that this goes hand in glove with the supposed free market for media that actually turns into being a state organ of censorship and suppression.
And corporate media telling us to focus on other things rather than the things right. that matter, which is why we do WOB Radio Hour. Well, WOB Radio now. It'll take a second for me to get adjusted. In other labor-related news, though, there have been massive strikes in England by teachers and nurses, and massive strikes numbering up almost a million people in Paris just last week. The strikes currently going on in England are amongst thousands of nurses who are part of the NHS, who are arguing for better wages and conditions. The teachers in England are also on strike and joining the nurses. There have been strikes and strike actions that have numbered tens of thousands of people all over England. Virtually all of the teachers in England are on strike right now and predict to be for the following future. In France, the reason why they're having such large strikes in that country is because the government wants to raise the retirement age by 2 years. I believe from 62 to 64 years of age would be the new legal limit of when you can retire. And virtually every single union has gone out on strike. There have been tens of thousands of people who support the unions joining these strikes as well. They have shut down entire cities. There's even a story of the electrical union, I think in Paris, shutting off power to wealthy people's homes and politicians' homes in order to pressure them to settle with the strikers on the workers' benefit while also giving out power to, you know, working class communities. So it really goes to show the distinction. And the reason why I wanted to mention this story is because over there, they still have to deal with a lot of the legalistic stuff in terms of labor regulations and labor law that we do in America. It's not terribly pro-worker over there either. On the other hand, their labor movement has been more militant than ours, arguably, over the past few decades. I mean, you think of the miners' strike in the 1980s in England. You think of the, well, when is nobody on strike in France, right? That's kind of the joke. They have a much more empowered and much more militant labor movement over here, whereas here in America, you know, the idea of a strike being that large, the last time there were even hundreds of thousands of people out on strike was, what, the Seattle General Strike in 1919?
Something
that anniversary was just last week. You know, when the labor-related news and the labor-related issues of the day are hardly being touched upon, it's seen as a niche interest or a fringe issue, whereas over there it encompasses everybody's lives because the unions really do fight to try and make sure that their workers have the best benefit. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
I might hazard to comment that the European, in general, class consciousness is way higher than in North America, but especially the United States.
Absolutely.
In North America, even the Canadians and the Mexican trade unions are more militant at greater, in Mexico, at greater risk, I would say, than the United States AFL-CIO or any other amalgamation of trade unions has been for the past, since World War II, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah, the labor movement on this country has, up until very recently, been on the decline, as I'm going to mention later, because of bills like the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948, and even arguably the Wagner Act of 1935, which I covered in the previous episode. We definitely do, like you said, I think, have a weaker concept of class consciousness, because the whole American ideal is anybody can make it rags to riches on their own individual merit and effort. The idea of collective participation in an organization is seen as something that's voluntary rather than necessary. Not to say that you shouldn't voluntarily do it. Nobody should force you to be a part of a union. But like on the other hand, it's in your better interest as a working class person to be a part of one. And so, yeah, no, the American myth kind of keeps us from thinking about socioeconomic class in general. And it's not until recently that concept has really kind of taken to the minds of a lot of people.
I would have to say taken to the minds of younger workers.
Mm-hmm.
Younger workers who have either, they're already in a union because their job requires it. And when they go try to find a steward for some kind of grievance or some kind of problem that they might have, they get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're forming these groups of concerted action, co-workers, you know, that is, by the way, protected under United States labor law still.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it on their own. And they're saying, you know, to hell with the business unions.
I think, yeah, and you hit the nail on the head of what I was about to say, which is that I think because of that, a lot of, we have had an influx, myself included, of younger members coming to the IWW.
Well, thank goodness.
Because we do, even though some of the trade unions, some of the locals do great work for their workers, on a larger level, like we say in our preamble, they're much happier to tell us the message that our employers can still have our benefits in mind in terms of how we operate as a union and what negotiations were allowed to take place. Where, you know, I think a lot of younger people are coming into the IWW now because they realize that that's not the case, really.
Exactly.
Right. We do encourage that more militant labor organization that really sticks up for workers, come thick or thin.
Oh, and to that point, I was asked not long ago by a podcast host about, so you want to get all these workers into the IWW? And I and my fellow worker said, not necessarily. And the guy went, what? We don't necessarily, if we can plant the idea in somebody's head that concerted activity for their own self-interest, they don't have to line up with the IWW. It'd be nice. We could use the $22 a month for dues, but we don't necessarily need to have them be in IWWs. The concept of industrial democracy and horizontal organizing is the most important part. And you'll see, you know, IWW was instrumental in the modern Starbucks workers movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, you know, we're not part of that union.
Right.
But they were definitely influenced by us. They started their own union, ditto with the Amazon workers. And the guy, shout out to fellow worker Chris Smalls, the guy who actually started that union in Staten Island, he actually got fired.
Yep.
He got fired, and he said, to hell with this, and he came back and kept organizing. I think that's admirable, commendable. And now, of course, you know, he's the president of that union.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he wasn't out to get a union paid job. He was out to organize his fellow workers. And I think that those seeds planted are starting to blossom in younger workers who have finally got the idea of, yeah, hell yeah, let's go on strike. You know, they owe it to us. They owe us an air conditioner in the kitchen. They owe us this and that. And those seeds that you plant can blossom and grow later. And it doesn't have to be with our imprimatur on it.
I think that also touches on something that I saw a while ago. And we are coming to the end of our labor news section, so I just want to cover this really quickly. I really like that you touched on the fact that membership is not a requirement in order to make change.
That's it.
Do we encourage you to become a member of the IWW?
Hell
yeah.
Do
we encourage you to organize your workplace? Do we encourage you, if you share our values or want to see our values, whether that's in your workplace or in your own communities, you know, disseminate and make the world a better place? Yes. But the idea that membership equals change is also what the AFL-CIO thinks.
Right.
And as we've seen from them, that's not always the case.
True.
Not everybody that organizes a workplace under the IWW necessarily has to sign a red card if they want to support the movement. As a matter of fact, there have been, I'm sure, historically, cases where workplaces have been organized through minority unionism, which we previously discussed, where most of the workers didn't sign on to the union, but they were still in support of it and still helping the work along, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's really important that you touched on that because, you know, we're not looking to get 100% of the factory
right. To
hold red cards. All we need is 80% of the population to be in support of the union and have the red card folks that want to actually help the work along, which we do encourage, to help that work along.
And unlike the AFL, the IWW does not have jurisdictional disputes.
Yes.
We do not argue with other unions about who represents whom. You know, for ours is a voluntary lineup. You want to line up with the IWW, you're more than welcome, but it's not a requirement.
And we organize by trade, not by specific craft, which allows us to, you know, have greater solidarity with our coworkers in any particular industry.
A little bit of a correction there, fellow worker. We organize by industry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that you said trade.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
But trades are considered, because we have different departments in our union,
mm-hmm.
naturally, you know, a typist is not going to have the same on-the-job concerns as a coal miner. But, you know, we're all part of the same one big union. That was the whole concept.
And with one more labor update, we're also going to be touching today on the Tacoma Art Museum and the AFSCME workers, which are still hoping to have a voluntary recognition of their union in the workplace. I have a snippet here, actually, from a newsletter that you can subscribe to for the Tacoma Art Museum Workers United. They've made a statement here talking about why voluntary recognition is crucial to union organizing. All eligible workers at TAM, Tacoma Arts Museum, deserve a union. And with over 80% support among eligible workers, we stand united in our commitment to forming one union together. This could be easily and legally accomplished should the board cease their union busting and voluntarily recognize our union. However, by voting to deny us voluntary recognition in November of 2022, the board is trying to break apart our solidarity. When the board voted to deny us voluntary recognition, they stated that granting recognition would, quote, sidestep the usual procedure for certifying a union, unquote, and, quote, sidestep the legal process through which employees vote on union representation, unquote, and suggested we go to a vote overseen by the NLRB. Not only are their reasons inaccurate, they are also classic union-busting tactics. We know the board knows that by trying to encourage us to go to a vote overseen by the NLRB, our union will be split apart.
You just stole my story.
Oh, well, go ahead, talk about it.
Well, I was aware of this. The museum workers want to join a union.
Mm-hmm.
For various reasons. Working conditions, pay, benefits, etc. But here's the catch. They asked for voluntary recognition. It was denied,
mm-hmm.
suggesting they should just go ahead and vote. I thought, well, why don't they just go ahead and vote? There's a reason for that. Labor law says that security guards cannot belong to the same union as the workers do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened here. That's what happened here in Tacoma. Splitting the workers. The security guards are workers too.
Right, absolutely.
For many of the workers at the museum, security guards are really important because they drive to work, they park behind the museum, and the lights were out. So they had to go back and forth from their cars to the museum in the dark. And it was of concern to some people. They don't want to do that.
That parking lot's in a lonely area.
Yeah, sure. There's nothing there. I think it's dangerous. They think it's dangerous, and they work there. So if they want, well, if they want to vote, you know, 51-49 or whatever for the union, that means the security guards will not be part of their union, and they want them to be part of the union because they're all in this together.
Absolutely.
Like the rest of us, yeah.
Yeah, they have interests in common, you know, security guards helping make sure that the workers are protected on the property to and from their car, as well as being in the art museum. And the workers really do appreciate the contributions of the security staff there, they're making sure that they're safe. The other reason why they're also saying, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Through NLRB elections, employers often set the conditions for how those elections are carried. And so what could happen if they force it to an NLRB election is that the employer could say, okay, this department has to vote separately from this department. This department isn't qualified or doesn't work long enough hours to be eligible to vote. The security department can't vote alongside the rest of the workers at the art museum. And it's basically like political gerrymandering. They cut the corners and cut the borders in just the right way so that even though the gross majority of the workers, like they said, over 80% of them support the union, could go and vote all in as one block, they will divide it up into smaller portions so that basically the election turns out in favor of the employer. And so this is a case study right here in Tacoma as to how that union busting tactic works. We've interviewed one of the fellow workers down there who's part of the union drive with AFSCME. And so they're still trying to pressure the board of directors at the art museum in order to have a voluntary recognition. There have been solidarity rallies over the past few months that have taken place downtown right out front of the art museum. We will let you know about future actions coming up that you, the fellow listener, can join through either this radio broadcast or through our Facebook page at WAB Radio Hour. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
Just to point out that the union being mentioned is AFSCME, which stands for American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. So this is a union that represents the public sector. Yes. Of the workforce, and they're a pretty good union.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Well, I was just thinking that when a person is part of something that has some power, you know, and with unions it's in a good way for the people, and that if the security guards become part of that union, or whatever union, they have a sense of pride, they have a sense of power and security, and don't you want security guards that really feel good on the job?
Absolutely, yeah. They deserve to be represented alongside everybody else there, and
just another point. Later we're going to be talking about police unions, but I just want to draw the differentiation between a security guard and a police officer.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, security guards are there for the property and for the personnel, right? And they're hired specifically. They give them a uniform, and they give them some authority, but they in no way have the authority that a police officer or a peace officer has.
You know, speaking of which, that is our roundtable discussion, and if we're all ready to jump into that, we can just go right on ahead and talk about it.
Sounds good.
Sure. Our roundtable discussion today with our fellow workers assembled is that we wanted to talk a bit about police unions. This topic came up as a result of the recent death of a man, Tyree Nichols, who, as many of you are aware, was beaten to death by five police officers.
In Memphis,
thank you. He was pulled over during a traffic stop. The officers engaged in some, as seen by their body cameras and street camera footage, some really heinous criminal behavior, to say the least. I won't go into detail because I know that can be a triggering topic for a lot of listeners. Needless to say, the footage which I have seen is horrifying enough not to describe, but yeah, he was beaten to death by these five officers.
Tased and tear gas or pepper
sprayed. Yes, he was tased, pepper sprayed. Each of the officers took turns beating him, And again, trying not to go into too much detail, he did die as a result of his injuries. The interesting part of this story, in terms of the police unions, which is what we're talking about today, is that in this case, the union immediately fired all five of those officers, which is pretty rare.
The union fired them, or the city?
The city fired them, and the union backed that decision.
Okay.
The reason why this is interesting is because police unions, which represent police officers, tend to be very defensive of the police officers that are part of the union in cases like this, historically. Oh. It's very hard for a police officer to get fired, even due to misconduct or brutality, because the union essentially pressures cities and counties into basically having things like qualified immunity.
We should talk about that, too.
Yes. Qualified immunity is a huge part of it. It's also part of some state laws as well, as far as I'm aware. And so, basically, this is opening it up to the broader topic of, you know, police being, quote-unquote, part of the labor movement, how that is historically inaccurate, and how police unions today continue to protect not just harmful individuals, quote-unquote, bad apples, as we hear in the press, but also just harmful systems of power and injustice. There's a reason why the IWW doesn't have them, not just because of the historical context of policemen being strike breakers and acting against working class interests, but also because police unions are a completely different animal. They defend the hardest, the worst members, and those that attempt to be whistleblowers or quote-unquote try to change the system from the inside out of good intentions by becoming a police officer themselves are often left to be targets of workplace discrimination and in some cases even violence. We in the IWW do not accept police officers into our union. We do not have police unions, nor have we ever historically had them because of this reason. Unions are meant to protect workers as a body, people who produce the things necessary in order for society to function. And in the IWW's view, whether you're a reformist or an abolitionist, we just do not see them as rank-and-file workers the way that we see, and historically the labor movement has seen rank-and-file workers. So
I've got a comment here. Fred Thompson, fellow worker Fred, died some years ago, but he was there, it seems like, from the beginning. And he did time in prison for his membership. Mm-hmm. So somebody asked him, who can't belong to the union? And he's the author of the first 50 years. It's a union history. There's one for the first 70 years, but it's been added on to after him. He said, no cops, no prison guards, and no district attorneys. Mm-hmm. They'd all been bad to him. Yeah.
You know, speaking of policemen as strike breakers, pretty much since some of the first major labor organizations formed in this country, even before the IWW formed in 1905, police have often been used predominantly in quote-unquote northern states, and this dates back to the Reconstruction era of the Civil War, and even before that, they have predominantly acted as protectors of
property,
the people who own property and capital's interests. And so they have historically been used as strike breakers. They were a very historic part of the Haymarket Affair, which historically in part helped kick off the IWW. This institution in northern states has predominantly acted as a union-busting organization, or strike-breaking organization, I should also say, whereas predominantly in the South, historically, they have been used as slave catchers. Or
that's
enforcing.
That's where cops started.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where the modern policing system roots itself, was the experience of Southern officers as slave catchers and enforcing Jim Crow Reconstructionist era racist laws. And as we have seen, this kind of structure that allows that violence to continue to happen has not really systemically changed. That is the historical context of the police. And in the modern day, they're not that much different.
It's New York City. Don't know the guy's name. I've forgotten it. Was a police officer, retired, and his new job is working for the New York City Police Union as a public information officer. So what that means is he's got his Bearcat scanner on all the time, and whenever he hears a call, there's been a shooting, he's there before the other reporters show up. And he's not a reporter. He's just there to define the incident for the first folks that get there. He tells a story about how bad it was and how these loyal guys in blue had to kill this person to protect their own lives. Mm-hmm. He defines the narrative.
Right.
He's a shill for the police union.
Exactly.
Right. The police unions, that's actually a very good point. They do often act as public relations outfits as mm-hmm. well.
That's where Ed Troyer got his start, right? That's a local Tacoma bad guy who was acquitted.
Yes, yes, he was.
He was.
Fellow worker Gordon?
Yeah, just to give the listening audience an idea of what we're talking about. Because there is an argument to be made that, okay, these guys work for a wage. Actually, they work for a salary, but it's negotiated like a wage. And for all intents and purposes, they are a workforce, right, mm-hmm. With a specific industry. But they've always organized themselves into benevolent associations and more of a guild-like structure. Or if you want to, like the AMA, the American Medical Association, it's practically a union for doctors, but they're considered educated and professionals, so therefore they don't have a union. But that puts the police in a kind of special category because they're working for the state to protect property and to protect the interests of capital, period. And so they're not really a workforce in that sense. They're more like domestic servants for the ruling class. And you can think that I'm being harsh, but the police don't consider themselves part of society at large. Mm-hmm. They don't consider themselves part of the working class. They're there to, they might be economically working class and come out of the working class. As a matter of fact, most police officers do, but they have no loyalty and no class consciousness. So from just a basic class-conscious analysis of who these people are, they're servants of capital. They're not producers of goods and services for the people. And so it took a long time for the IWW to actually constitutionally ban them. It didn't happen that long ago. But that it's in the Constitution now, because it was always just a given. It was understood. But the issue came up because people were concerned that these were workers, and they're not actually. They're muscle. They're gun thugs for capital.
Yeah, absolutely. And whether it's the case of Tyree Nichols, whether it's any other police brutality incident, these people are here to protect themselves. They're here to protect the people who pay them, which tends to be the government. They're often hired to protect private property more than the individual or even collective rights of citizens. And so just on a values basis and a class conscious basis, like you said, fellow worker Gordon, you know, these people cannot be woven into our institution.
Right.
And so
they've always been used to put down the working class.
Absolutely.
I do have a little bit I'd like to add to this.
Go ahead.
For example, if your cat's stuck up in a tree mm-hmm. and you need help, don't call the cops. Call a Girl Scout.
Yeah, call a girl. Yeah, or yeah. Because call the fire department.
Anybody, your chances of getting shot are reduced.
Yes.
If the fire department shows up, or your Girl Scout troop, you're getting out of the tree.
Yeah. I don't know anymore. You don't know for sure.
Well, you know, at least the fire department won't kill you when they arrive. They'll probably help the situation more than harm. But
well,
yeah. So that's just kind of the roundtable discussion on police unions, if that even is a discussion. I mean, what's there to really disagree on, at least in this organization, that, you know, the police have never really been our friends, whether you're unionists or you're working class or you're part of a marginalized community. The AFL-CIO may have taken them in as part of their union outfit. They are very much embraced and welcomed there. They're seen as quote-unquote fellow workers because, like you said, they are a workforce. Mm. But it is very ironic, and I've seen cartoons dated from the early 1900s that lampooned this. It's very ironic that they march in the AFL-CIO parade with the very same people that next week they might be hitting with batons or pepper yep. spraying in order to break up a strike of the workers that they are marching with. So it is a very contradictory existence, but as we've said before many times, the AFL-CIO just has some very interesting and disagreeable opinions about who should be considered part of the labor movement. And we as the IWW are one of the few organizations that says, no, they should not be. They're a class unto themselves.
All cats are beautiful?
Yeah, there we go. All cats are beautiful, especially the black cat, which is one of the logos of the IWW. Moving on to our labor law brief here, this is just a bit of labor law. I've been doing an educational section for about a couple minutes every radio episode. Previously, we covered the Wagner Act of 1935. Today, I want to cover the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948, which undid a lot of the benefits to workers and unions that came out of the result of the Wagner Act. So basically, Taft-Hartley was an act that was passed in 1948. It was named after the two senators who proposed it. And basically what it did was essentially ban unions from a lot of their more effective organizing and striking activities. Things like secondhand boycotts, things like other unions going out on strike in solidarity with a particular union, even if they're two branches of the same union. Wildcat strikes were famously banned, which is going out on strike without the permission of your labor officers, essentially, so on and so forth. So this was kind of seen as a turning point in the history of American organized labor because it was so contradictory to the interests of workers, and more specifically, very much aimed at organizations like the IWW, which was struggling but still alive at the time because the AFL-CIO still had many quote-unquote radical left-wing members that were fantastic organizers and, you know, really effective members of those unions, the CIO especially. And so the Taft-Hartley Act also mandated that anybody too far to the left, quote-unquote, you know, at the height of the Second Red Scare, communists, were essentially kicked out of the AFL-CIO. So this was a very impactful piece of labor legislation that has had some pretty far-reaching effects even to this day. Any thoughts?
Yeah, the Labor Management Relations Act is the official name for Taft-Hartley. Mm-hmm. Everybody refers to it as Taft-Hartley because it's easier. But that act specifically outlawed the best tactics of the labor movement to date. The whole idea of sympathy strike, and I mentioned earlier that some unions scab on each other. Well, this makes it almost inevitable. Okay, I'm a machinist. And down here, the meat cutters have gone out on strike. In the olden days, we could say, well, our local respects their picket line, and we're going out on strike, too, until the meat cutters' demands are met. Mm-hmm. Well, that's specifically prohibited. Also, membership in organizations, that was considered security a threat, like the Socialist Workers' Party, the Communist Party of the United States, and a little outfit known as the IWW. They were all put under the same aegis of radical syndicalism, and that was specifically outlawed by LMRA. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm getting at is that LMRA, or the Taft-Hartley Act, is the most significant block to worker progress and has also contributed to the dissolution of worker solidarity to the point where some unions do scab on other unions. And it just, in spirit, it almost crushed the spirit of the entire labor movement. And it is a heinous, heinous law.
And I would even go so far as to say that it forces unions to scab on other unions even when the workers don't want to.
That's true.
There you go.
In the majority of cases, they are essentially forced to keep working and break the picket line and ultimately break the strike because the law says if you do a sympathy strike, we'll fine the union, we'll send out the cops. Mm-hmm.
I think this happened sometime in the 70s when I was in the Carpenters Union, referring to Taft-Hartley. I believe coal miners were on strike. Mm-hmm. And in sympathy, the railroad workers didn't want to haul the coal. Obviously a good tactic. And the response was, well, you can't do that. It's a sympathy strike. Taft-Hartley forbids it. And my response to that was, well, what the hell? Taft can mine it and Hartley can haul it. You know? Yeah.
That's a good slogan. As for what's going on with the Supreme Court right now, as we've mentioned previously, the Supreme Court is currently hearing a case that would ultimately make strikes nigh impossible because any damages to employers caused by a strike, including quote-unquote economic damages, loss of profits, would essentially be charged to unions and thus make it very financially draining to unions to have strikes. This is definitely part of the foundation as to why that current Supreme Court case is happening. The right to strike is getting tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, where only the unions that might have the best funds or, you know, the best donations from people that are even aware of the strike and give into the strike fund, things like that, it is becoming an even more narrow possibility as a result of this act from 1948 in order for workers to stand up for themselves in a way that's actually meaningful and, as we say in the IWW, gets the goods. So, yes, fellow worker Lynn?
It just seems so counterintuitive, so false that could have what you were just talking about.
Well, it's only counterintuitive because the employers wrote that bill. Yeah.
But it's just incredible that that could be the case.
Like we said, you know, we try to foster solidarity as much as we can, but when you have laws like this that are still part of our, you know, federal code as to how unions can even behave, this is kind of where we are with unionism right now in this country is the inevitable result. And so, you know, if there are any sympathetic senators and representatives listening, although I highly doubt that, please try to repeal this. Please,
and contact us.
Yeah, please contact the IWW when you want to quit your job. Yeah. And now fellow worker Gordon would like to give us a Kitsap Labor Notes update about his recent experience with OT-101. Take it away.
Greetings, fellow workers and fellow listeners. My name is fellow worker Gordon, and I'm here to talk to you about events regarding the labor movement from that wonderful land across the Narrows Bridge, Kitsap County, and Bremerton and environs. So I'll just get right into it and tell you that I don't have very much news from Kitsap County right now, except that we're continuing to grow our IWW branch. We're continuing to work with some allied organizations out there to help. Our first project is to try to help some of the unhoused that are in Bremerton proper. And we're growing the membership. And we're also growing our scope as to what our particular mission out in that area will be as a general membership branch. And the reason I don't have that much news is that last weekend, I spent the weekend in Bellingham, Washington, close to the Canadian border. And I was attending what's called an OT-101. So it's like a college class. You take English 101 or you take, you know, Algebra 101. This is Organizer Training 101, and it's a specific program developed by the IWW from experience all across the nation and in Canada as to how do we go about actually organizing our workplace and why are we doing this? And it starts off with real basics like what is a union? You'd be surprised that even people who work in a union workplace and who have to belong to a union or who have decided to belong to a union know very little about why it's there, what it does, how it operates, and where their money is going. So OT-101, and there is an OT-102, which I haven't attended yet, but OT-101 gets right to the roots of what a union is and how it should be and not how it is necessarily under the current arrangement. And it's a very well thought out and constructed program that spans 2 days, and they mean it. Our stuff, we had breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning, which is an ungodly early hour for me, but I attended. We had breakfast, and they provide that. And training starts at 0900, 9 o'clock in the morning, sharp, and it lasted until 5 o'clock in the afternoon with an hour, you know, or half hour break actually for lunch. We were going to have a picket about that because we wanted a longer lunch hour, but, you know, we decided just to go along with the union. But basically, we started out with what is a union and what we want to do with it. And the reason a union exists is to make conditions good or better for you in the workplace. And the way the IWW defines a union is two or more workers acting together to improve conditions and change the balance of power in the workplace. And the key words that they gave us was that our union, solidarity unionism, which is what we practice, is direct, democratic, and caring. And that's an unusual thing to hear from a labor union, is caring, right? You know, because usually they're the tough guys, they run the show, and you just go along with what they tell you. But direct, democratic, and caring is the crux of how our union organizes. We organize ourselves. And we care for each other, right? And that builds solidarity. So we do it first from understanding our workplace, which a process we call mapping, which could be, okay, what does the company produce? Where does it get its raw goods? And how do they distribute? So basically, when we're going to advocate for a union, it's because of working conditions. People have problems. Either it's pay, either it's atmosphere, either it's seniority, scheduling, and all these things we address. But basically, we start out knowing that we're going to be in a position to advocate for our fellow workers, and we're also going to be in a position to advocate for ourselves and other workers outside of that workplace. And we these processes that have developed over the decades, like workplace mapping, social mapping, identifying leaders and identifying leadership characteristics. And the primary thing I got, of course, AEIOU, which fellow worker Noah has been explaining in the past several episodes, they use that's a very strong principle, which just briefly, it means to agitate, educate, inoculate, organize, and unionize. And their key takeaway I got is that our trainers, two trainers come out, volunteers from the Seattle General Membership Branch who are experienced in this, and they said it's 80% listening and 20% responding. Yeah, so when you're organizing your co-workers and fellow workers, listen first. People will go on about their problems, but you'll see patterns emerging. Things like, well, Mary and Sue and Elizabeth don't have anybody to watch their kids. And it's a big hassle for them. And they don't have to come to you and tell you that. You just can pick that up. So being a good listener is key to being a good organizer. So they go into other techniques of like setting up a first meeting with a worker on a one-on-one basis. Not pressuring them, not mentioning the U word, they called it, which means don't start off right out of the gate by saying union, and we're going to change stuff. Start out of the gate by just listening and giving your considered attention to your fellow workers. So other things that they explained, as well as AEIOU, was how to understand when your workplace is getting ready to actually take some action. And they don't necessarily emphasize having an NLRA election.
NLRB
election. They don't emphasize getting a contract. They don't emphasize any of these high and lofty goals, like getting a good retirement plan. They say, what's our immediate concern? Oh, it's 108 degrees in the kitchen. Okay, that's an example. Start with that. And then there are direct action techniques you can employ to get that little problem solved. And if you can do that without having to upset, you know, the apple cart, as it were, and getting everybody all riled up, you know, you could just get simple demands met. And what does that do? It demonstrates solidarity and it demonstrates worker power.
Absolutely.
So even if we just have an old machine that is a copy machine. And I'm thinking of the movie Office Space now. But for instance, if we have an old copy machine that's just a big pain in the neck and everybody's been complaining about it and management doesn't do anything about it, we take care of it ourselves. Suddenly it's gone. Okay, well, what happened to it? Well, we don't know, you know. That's direct action. And it might seem childish and it might seem dangerous.
Might seem effective too.
Very effective. So they stressed direct action in the workplace before, you know, we get to a point where we take a major action like a march on the boss, you know, and way before any kind of action that would involve, you know, having a regular union election under the auspices of the National Labor Relations Act. So the training went on to show how to organize a committee, how to keep membership interested, and the big takeaway I got out of the whole training is that, now I've been to a couple of these before, and it seemed to me that it was like a, I don't know, completing the maze. If you're a rat running through the maze and you get to the cheese, well, then you win. Then you've won your workplace action. And that's sort of how it seemed to me, even though I know that wasn't the spirit. But right from the get-go, these two trainers, shout out to the two trainers from Seattle GMB, they mentioned that it's an ongoing process. So when we start a one-on-one with a fellow worker, 6 months from now, we should probably touch base again. See how things are going. Keep continuity.
Preferably sooner, probably.
Yes, oh, definitely. But, you know, and especially in a shop with under 100 employees, you know, and there's all kinds of ways we can get, they stressed communication and getting contact lists and how to gather people together to discuss these things, whether virtual or in person. And the big thing I got was that it's an ongoing process. It's constant renewal and always getting back to the basics.
Keep the plant watered.
That's it.
Yep. Thank you so much for that report.
You're welcome. It was a wonderful experience, and I recommend, even if you're not an IWW member, if your local IWW branch knows of or is going to sponsor an OT 101, Organizer Training 101, please come and participate. It's free. We actually give you breakfast, and you'll learn a lot. Even if you don't line up with the IWW, you will help your co-workers in your workplace.
Thank you so much, fellow worker.
And I've got a comment or two on this. Several times you were made reference to raw materials working in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of an industrial point of view. But let's not forget, I keep saying this, the average or typical union member in this country at this time is she's usually in her 30s and she's working on her master's degree. I'm referring to nurses.
Yeah.
And teachers.
Absolutely.
So that's, well, call it a knowledge factory if you want to, but...
But you're right.
See, the Rust Belt and those manufacturing jobs have went someplace else.
As I'm a veteran of steam whistle industry myself, so I kind of have that bias.
Well, so do I.
I've had to learn.
To be fair, we do use this kind of quote-unquote warehouse or manufacturing kind of language because that has been passed along by, like you said, the union movement in previous decades. But just to stress, this OT 101 can work for any workplace with any body of workers that's interested in organizing on the job for better wages, hours, and conditions and the democratic management of their working lives. This OT 101 is a fantastic resource. I've taken it myself. I've really enjoyed a lot of the lessons that I've been able to employ in my own particular working situation. And, you know, if anybody is interested, as Gordon has said, you can reach out to a local IWW branch. We have Facebook pages for each one of our branches. Or you can contact us through IWW.org. You can look up a local branch on that website as well. You can even reach out to us at WOB Radio through our Facebook page, and we can ask around local union branches here in Washington State and see when they're hosting their next OT 101. It's a fantastic resource if you're a worker on the job who wants to organize. Thank you so much, fellow worker.
Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH, LP Tacoma.
And now to give an update on the Home in Tacoma for All campaign. Here's fellow worker Marilyn giving us a brief report of their event that they held on the 11th of February. This is being recorded after the earlier part of the episode was recorded because we wanted to make sure that we talked about this in our episode, which is why this week's episode is delayed. So, fellow worker Marilyn, if you wouldn't mind starting off just telling us a little bit about Home in Tacoma for All and what they're trying to achieve here in Tacoma.
Home in Tacoma for All is working to win a tenant's rights ballot initiative on the ballot.
Right.
So they've been working for a while on equity issues and justice for tenants because of the rising eviction of medium and low-income workers in Tacoma because of rising rents.
Absolutely. I heard that Tacoma has one of the fastest rent increase rates in the country, actually. I think you ranked number 2 or 3. I read that in the... I can't remember if it was the Tacoma Weekly or if it was the Seattle Times, but they said it was a 20% increase from 2020 to 2022. So that's a pretty steep rent increase.
Right.
Yeah.
And while the wheels of justice are grinding very slowly in the state to work on some of these issues, some of these things are within the power of our city council and our county council.
Right. So in terms of a tenant's bill of rights, I guess what would be some of the things that they're talking about, like giving a longer term?
I want to go back a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So the event on last Saturday was pretty well attended, considering that there were other things going on. There were nearly 100 people, which was great. And one of our own Wobblies, Sean, was one of the featured speakers, and he did an incredible job speaking from an indigenous point of view. Anyhow, of the 100 people who came down to First United Methodist Church, We had breakout groups, and we did education and also a rally. And the points that we're educating people on, listen carefully. So we want landlords to not be able to charge unfair or excessive move-in fees or late fees. They must not charge non-refundable and refundable move-in fees that together total more than 1 month's rent. This would include security deposits and first and last in the works. And they may not collect deposits greater than 25% of 1 month's rent. Late fees are capped at $10 a month. Late fee accrual following the end of the lease is prohibited. So they can't pile up. They must give 6 months' notice of rent increases and pay relocation assistance when rent increases require tenants to relocate. So I think that's crucial.
That sounds like a lot of protections. You'd think that that would be already something that would be enforced at some level of the law, but unfortunately...
Well, the state, again, is working on things, but who knows if that'll get approved or not.
Mm-hmm. And so the whole purpose of this campaign is to essentially get an initiative on the ballot, hopefully coming up here soon in the
yes.
next election, so that we can actually
yes.
have a tenant's bill of rights.
And here's one of my favorites. Landlords are prohibited from evicting children or educators during the school year or carrying out other unjust evictions during the school year.
Hmm.
So that's so disruptive to the children. When the parents end up being homeless and their education is disrupted, and it's disrupting for teachers. They don't make all that much money.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
I can also imagine it would be interrupting to a child's education if their family was getting evicted and, say, it was during the coronavirus lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing classes online or they're doing
exactly.
mix online
exactly.
in-person classes. Suddenly you're out of internet for a few days. You get behind on your coursework.
Well, you know, that's a whole issue with us selling Click.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a different topic than the tenants' rights. But these are the bases of them. And it's deadly cold in the wintertime, and people die. Over 200 people died last year as a result of homelessness.
Wow.
Yeah, and in Pierce County, Tacoma.
Wow. That's quite a number of people. You'd think that that would be a more highlighted public emergency than it's being treated as currently.
Right. No more prayers and thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got to do something. So the issue is that we need to collect about 7,000 signatures by the mid-May.
Wow, that's coming up. I mean, we're currently in mid-February right now, so we still got a few months to get this together.
Yeah, and they're deliberately doing an overage because every time you collect signatures, you have the issue of some of them are invalidated. People sign twice and they don't realize it,
mm-hmm.
or they don't realize that they have to have their accurate address. And if they've moved, they have to re-register. So what they're asking for is on March 4th, they're going to have a kickoff for gathering signatures. And they want people to come out. They're raising money to run a professional campaign. And they're building a broad labor community coalition.
I've heard that several unions have endorsed this program,
yes.
this initiative
yes.
as well. Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, Patty Rose came and spoke. And she's the secretary of the Pierce County Labor Council, and I love her to pieces.
Mm.
And so she's on board with this, and she's a solid person. She's a solid person.
Absolutely. It is really nice to see, and we've talked about this on WOB Radio before, you know, trying to find an intersection with organized labor and all of these different
oh,
issues
yeah.
of the day, such as, you know, fair and stable housing. In an initiative campaign like this, I think
mm-hmm.
it's very nice that we have the support of labor unions that recognize that, you know, housing is a right and that there are ways to organize it and lend their support to
right.
that cause.
Once upon a time in Tacoma, not too very long ago, there was an initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
We got enough signatures, but the city council quickly patched together another initiative that they threw in front of their voters, which didn't have the same clout and protections.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that's likely to happen again. So one of the things we did in this particular rally is we practiced and anticipated some of the things that our opposition might do. I mean, first of all, who's our opposition? It may be landlords. I'm not against all landlords. What I'm against is these entities that come in from out of town and build these apartments and use our city tax abatement for 10 to 12 years and build the absolute minimum of affordable housing. Like, I think it's like for a 35-unit apartment building, they have to do 5 or something like that, where it's low-income housing. And what it's resulting in is buildings being demolished or available land that could be used for a better purpose becoming unavailable to do really supported housing. And that's a thing that the city has to do. They have to do. And they have to realize the level of the need, because now they're going to be building 2 buildings on, I think it's South J or South L. They had their groundbreaking a few weeks ago, and I went down to it. And what they're doing is good. They're throwing almost all of their money into it that they've got, federal, state, county, everything. It will result in office buildings down below on the ground level and a total of 225 units for supported housing. That's a step. We have over 1,000 unhoused people here in Tacoma. So it doesn't address the real issue. It doesn't address the real issue that the rents have gone up 43% in the last year in Tacoma, that people that who have been lifelong residents are being squeezed out. We have work to do. I want to encourage everybody listening to take advantage of the opportunity to engage in a community forum at the City Council, which is on the second Tuesday of the month. City Council meets at 5 o'clock. You can sign up. And at a community forum, you can speak on any topic you want. Unfortunately, the city gives you 90 seconds, but you can speak, and it will go on the record. And if you bother to vote, they will bother to listen at some level.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is good to be engaged in, you know, civic participation like that, whether it's, you know, attending city council meetings or talking to people about initiatives like this, which will hopefully be on the ballot. I'm certainly going to sign the initiative if I haven't already. God knows I've signed so many initiatives over the past couple of years, but this is something that...
Well, the trouble with initiatives is that every year, if they don't pass, you think you've already signed them, but they have to be resubmitted. They'll have a different number for the initiative, and they probably will have a different name. The issue will be the same, but it's an every year thing. You can't just sign once.
Right.
And we get so inundated with online petitions, and these are ones that have to be done in person. If you're interested in helping out, please, March 4th, there will be a rally, and I believe it's going to be at Parable. And Parable is on McKinley Street. I think it's the 3200 block. But if you go on to Tacoma for All, and that's Tacoma, letter 4, all, or if you go on the Tacoma Democratic Socialist website, you will get more information, or Facebook.
Absolutely.
You will get more information about exactly where and when this is going to be. Altogether, I think it was a very successful event, and I was proud to see several fellow Wobblies there. I know a lot of people in our Wobb Radio group couldn't be there because they were doing Wobb Radio.
Yeah.
But there were the others, and that's good, too.
Yeah, thank you so much for reporting on that. We definitely want to give more updates to this campaign as it goes on. This is probably one of the more interesting and significant local ballot initiatives that I'm aware of, because just having that tenant bill of rights would put us so far ahead in terms of what kind of power that renters can have over their living conditions, over how much they pay in order to live where they do, so that they can maybe live in an environment that's more walkable, has access to more resources, is easier to get to their jobs on a day-to-day basis. It's really, the quality of housing and the price of housing determines so much of our lives. It's just like wages in the workplace.
Yeah, housing is a human right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, period.
It is. And it is good that this is a step in the right direction to where we can say tenants have rights, as with housing as a human right is kind of the fundamental idea of it. So therefore, the tenants need to have rights get granted to them by the government as well.
Well, you know, this was so incredibly timely because I have a friend that's rather elderly, and she has been living in a horrible, horrible little apartment for, I think, 30 years. The landlord has done nothing. There's paint and chips peeling off the walls. Her sink in the kitchen hasn't worked for years. She's getting older. She's going blind. She's beginning to show some signs of dementia. And that morning, she was found by some friends of mine on the floor. She had fallen and broken her hip, and she'd laid there overnight. And the question is, okay, now she's in the hospital. She's not going to be able to go back to that place. It's not safe for her. What can she do on her $500 a month? So the group that I led a breakout group. And because I was on the same floor as the event, and it's a two-story building, most of the people who came to my event were disabled because they couldn't do the stairs. And so the whole group tended to focus on issues around housing justice for people that are disabled.
Accessibility, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the people was a former resident at the Merkel Apartments, which was disabled adults, and they had received a no-cause eviction. And listener, what that is you didn't do anything wrong. Somebody just bought your building, and they want to kick everybody out, spruce it up, and make a whole lot more money. So he was there, and then a person with some mental health issues was there, another person that had physical disabilities, and we talked about the challenges that they face finding housing. So it was an eye-opening breakout group. Please consider coming down and helping get signatures and putting the time in to get those signatures and get this on the ballot. We can anticipate that we will run into opposition. Yep. But one of the things the listener needs to know is that these types of protections that we're demanding are not for the little mom and pop. You know, we have an extra room in our house, or we have, you know, something like that. It's not for them. It's for the large, greedy, I'm going to say it, apartment complex people.
Right. Yeah. People like property investors, large-scale housing developments owned by some kind of property manager, corporate property manager, things like that.
I have a friend that has, they bought a house across the street from them. They're in Hilltop area. They were concerned about some of these things because they thought it would drive them out of business if they had a tenant that was bad. Well, first of all, it's not for bad tenants, tenants that trash the place. It's for no-cause evictions. I mean, everybody deserves a place to live.
Absolutely.
And it wouldn't affect them anyhow. So you're going to probably hear a lot of garbage from people who are saying that it's going to make it unfeasible to rent a room or rent an ADU, and that is not the situation. One of the things we need to do going into this is have our eyes open to see what kind of smokescreen the opposition throws up.
And also their connections to the political circle here in Tacoma as well, because I imagine there's probably going to be some pushback from the city council on this issue as well. Just like you mentioned with several years ago, there was a campaign to raise the wages. The city council put out their own initiative, which eventually beat the 15 an hour minimum wage campaign. And so we should probably expect something the same to face up against this.
Well, and the city of Tacoma has a pretty bad record with city council members either being architects and having an interest in building and properties, or being real estate agents after they leave.
Right.
And so that's just a conflict of interest that probably was there all along that didn't surface until they left office. They've been feathering their nests.
At the end of the day, you know, they have to make the people with money who drop money into their campaigns happy in some way, shape, or form. And that's the same on a local level as it is on a national level, you know. No matter what kind of progressive policies like this that you try to push, and even if there are politicians that are sympathetic to it, at the end of the day, there are some very big, tight strings pulling on these people.
Yeah.
And it will ultimately take people-led initiatives and campaigns like this with enough mass power in order to get that into the framework of our daily lives, frankly.
Yeah. So that's one thing, but I also wanted to remind the listener that March 8th is the International Day of Women.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been since 1909. Of course, when it started, it wasn't all that established. I want to do a little history. In the early 1900s, women were experiencing pay inequality, duh, and a lack of voting rights, duh, and they were mad, duh. And 15,000 women marched through New York City in 1908 to demand their rights. In 1909, the first National Women's Day was observed, in accordance with a declaration by the Socialist Party of America.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to the socialists. And it was originally celebrated on the last Sunday of February until 1913. It's organized internationally. I want to encourage people to think about this. If you live in Tacoma, at this point in time, it's looking pretty quiet for International Women's Day. And it happens to fall on a Wednesday. I looked it up. And I want to encourage people to think about putting together an event. And I'm going to put out a challenge. I'm thinking of two things. I'm thinking of showing up for city council,
mm-hmm.
and coming with signs to encourage them to declare it in Tacoma. And I'm also considering encouraging a celebration for all women, LGBTQI individuals. Come down to Wright Park spontaneously on March 8th, that's Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good time to do that? Let's say at least we're going to have a little more daylight. We don't know what the weather's going to be like. Rain or shine, come out. Bring an umbrella if you need it. I'll try to bring down a canopy of some sort. Let's celebrate. Let's sing. Let's dance. Let's share food. Let's share joy and celebrate womanhood and celebrate our bodies and celebrate that we're going to fight the Supreme Court tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get rowdy. So Wednesday, March 8th, I will be there with my umbrella and my canopy and something good to eat and some kind of sign. And I would love to see other people join me. And that's the beginning of something. Now let's see where we can take it.
And if there are any men listening, there's a saying in the IWW, actually it was a very famous stickerette, I think from the 60s or 70s, and it was basically saying something along the lines of, if men and boys don't help the women with the washing up, then the new world can't be built from the ashes of the old. You know, there is such an ignorance to the unpaid labor of women in the function of everyday life. If it were an industry into itself, it would be worth almost tens and tens of billions of dollars worth of unpaid labor that women do every day to help out their families, to help out their communities. And it's a really good, you know, International Women's Day is a really good day to remember.
You know the words of Bread and Roses, don't you?
I'm not off the top of my head. I know I've sung it before.
As we come marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, 1,000 mill lofts gray, are touched by all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we come marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient cry for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. And it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But the African word expression for that is women hold up half the sky.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that one too, yeah.
Yeah.
For all the women holding up half the sky, we look forward to seeing whatever celebrations or local community events or good times that come a-rollin' come March 8th, right?
March 8th.
March 8th.
All over the world.
All over the world. But yeah, no, Bread and Roses is a long time song in the Little Red Songbook of the IWW.
Yeah.
It's had a long history. It was from the Lawrence Strike of 1912.
That's right.
The textile strike. It was one of the biggest actions ever taken by the industrial workers of the world.
And you know who could really tell us about that is Mac, because he's from that area.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's probably one of my favorite IWW songs out of that whole book. I heard Utah Phillips do a beautiful live acoustic rendition of it as well. Yeah. It really is a timeless song and really a testament to our history as a union, and also the women in our union who paved so much of our early history and so much of our biggest actions, like the Lawrence Textile Strike of 1912. We're going to give you some local events that have previously occurred as well as upcoming, and we'll go ahead and start things off with you, fellow worker.
Well, thank you. I want to start by saying this month is the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I was almost there, which means I got a ride with the AIM caravan from Seattle, and there's a long line of cars. They just pull up at a gas station, and they just kept filling up the cars, except for the last two, which were two FBI guys who followed us all the way from Seattle to,
whoa.
Anyway, what's this all about? The occupation of Unity, it was a trading post run by white folks on the reservation, and it was at the site of the Wounded Knee Massacre of, I don't know, 1860-something.
Later than that.
1870s then?
No, it was way into the, 1880s, like that.
Only two decades off. where the U.S. military, the cavalry, the army, killed women and children, old men.
Yeah.
Left them in the snow. So that was a memorial for this. And there was issues involving the tribal council versus the elders in the tribe, or tribes, the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, or was it 36, imposed tribal councils, Indian reservations. And that means they ignored or overlooked what they had been doing for centuries, which is people sat around and talked to each other about problems and how to resolve them. And it was not just 51% vote. It was consensus. And the elders preferred to retain that. Well, since the feds, Department of Interior, Department of Indian Affairs, was giving money to the tribal councils, it was a valued position for some folks. And because of the opposition of the elders, people were killed. Drive-bys. And I think, and I can't prove it, but the government paid for that. I mean, they paid Richard Wilson to run the tribal council, and he paid his relatives, his buddies, to kill the opposition. So they called AIM, the American Indian Movement, in Minneapolis to come down and help. And they did. And it was 70-some days. I was there for about a week, not at Wounded Knee because we couldn't get through the security guards. The location was surrounded by the military. And there was another perimeter before that, which was the Goon Squad, the Guardians of the Ogallala Nation. And I think those were America's death squads. Because I had some guy jerk me out of a pickup truck, stick a gun in my face, and say, "Get out the car, white boy." And I was, oh, God. And then I thought, years later, no, he's not going to kill me. He'd have to shoot the driver, too. And the driver was a blood. So he just turned us around, and we hauled the potatoes and the diapers back to where we came from. So a couple of years later, this is where the Leonard Peltier story, I guess, he was there, but it continues. Two FBI agents drove onto the reservation to the Jumping Bull family compound, and there was a firefight broke out. Don't know who shot first. Joe Stunstreich, Indian man, was killed, and nobody cared about that, apparently, but two FBI agents died, and three men were charged. Dino Butler, Bob Robidoux, Leonard's cousin, I guess, yeah.
He just recently passed, didn't he?
I think so, yeah. He was living in Spain. It was better for him. And, let's see. Oh, and Leonard. Three guys. Leonard feared he wouldn't get a fair trial. So he booked off to Canada, where he was captured and extradited later based on false testimony. Our government lied to the Canadian government, and there's at least one politician in Canada who's still upset about this. Yeah. The big, bad Americans lied to us, and we turned over a political prisoner. Anyway, Robidoux and Butler were tried in Rapid City, no, I'm sorry, in Iowa, somewhere, and were acquitted by reasons of self-defense. Their lawyers got to present all the history that was going on and why they thought their lives were in danger, so they shot back. Or, I don't know. When Leonard was extradited, his trial was in Bismarck, North Dakota, in front of a notoriously racist judge, and nobody knows who signed the paperwork. I mean, why did they transfer the trial to North Dakota? Nobody in the government's going to tell you. I also went to an evidentiary hearing when they reviewed the materials that were used to convict, the information was used to convict Leonard. I'll never forget this. Special Agent Evan Podge, the forensics, the top guy in the FBI who did the extractor scratchings, markings of the weapon that apparently killed these two FBI guys, or at least one of them. Leonard's lawyer, I saw Leonard in court, yeah, his lawyer jumped up and said, Your Honor, you know, this contradicts what the FBI guy said, you know, in these reports in that trial. And then Evan Hodge said, oh, you're right, Your Honor, I misspoke myself. I didn't lie to you, I just misspoke myself. Mm. And that didn't work either. I mean, nothing. Leonard's been in prison for years.
46 years.
46 years, and he's in his 70s, he's diabetic, among other things. Mm-hmm. He's been tortured, he's been abused. Again, there's another campaign for a pardon, amnesty. Just let him go home, for goodness sakes.
There's like several marches, I believe. Oh. Even one in D.C. that were asking for his release.
Yes, yes. This has gone on for decades, and it's now getting close to... It's time for Leonard. Something's going to happen.
Yep,
and, absolutely. He probably will not be released. I'm not optimistic about that. But people should know that...
this country still has political prisoners.
That's right. And there's more, but I'll just leave it at that. So remember Leonard in your prayers, if you do pray. His people are praying for him with eagle feathers and sage. And us atheists are going to mumble, I guess. So yeah. Anyway, I'd like just to remember Leonard's still in prison, and we hope that things get better for him.
Absolutely.
And there's a local Tacoma outfit, the Leonard Peltier Offense Defense Committee, and the Puyallup Tribe. They're heavily involved with the Leonard Peltier case. I've been, and other Wobblies in Tacoma have been on a couple of Leonard Peltier marches downtown. It should be remembered that the late fellow worker Arthur Miller was a key person in that campaign here in Tacoma.
Absolutely.
And he is an IWW, you know, down to the bone. And so our interests are pretty much wrapped up in Leonard's interests, and we still support him.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, fellow worker.
Yeah, and then another shout-out, as well as for Leonard Peltier, just recently found out that there's a protest going on in Atlanta over over land, public land being seized and logged off so that a police training facility could be built. And that police training facility is nicknamed Cop City. And so there's been a bunch of environmental people protesting the logging and the lack of an environmental impact statement and all that. And so a lot of people have been coming in to Atlanta from out of town to this forest site. And one of our fellow workers from Tallahassee, Florida, General Membership Branch, nicknamed Tortuguita. And he was an IWW from Tallahassee that went up to lend his support and solidarity. And he was shot down in cold blood by, I guess, the Atlanta Police Department or the state police.
I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a terrible situation. So you can get the news of this if you just, you know, go on IWW.org and take a look there. And also the mainstream news is carrying some of it.
Mm-hmm. There have been huge protests over that. Thousands of people that are trying to keep the police from developing this fake city for training. Yes, fellow
recruiter?
Just
an interpretation of his name. It's a little tortoise.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you so much for that. Yeah, it's sad when a fellow IWW member dies, but to have somebody die in a situation like that where he should not have died.
Right.
I mean, that's just again, like we just said, there are political prisoners, there are people who are still dying for causes for the working class, and so it's good that we remember them and shout their names whenever these kinds of situations arise, because it's amazing how easily some people can be forgotten like that.
Because we never forget.
That's right.
We in the IWW never forget.
And thank you so much, fellow listeners, for tuning in to WOB Radio. This has been a production of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. We are currently broadcasting out of 101.9 Low Power FM Radio Tacoma. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you tune in again.
See you on the streets.
And solidarity.